Welcome to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. I'm Gus Cantavero, the producer of the In Context War Report, and now the host of In Context, Ken McDermott Rowe.
Hi, this is Ken McDermott Rowe. Gus and I are joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe. Hi, Marshawn.
Hello, everyone.
In the War Report, we report on recent developments on wars around the world. We show how these developments fit into the global geopolitical picture and how they affect U.S. national security. In today's edition of the War Report, we're going to discuss the history of proxy warfare and see how this history applies to the global wars of today. But first, let's review some important developments over the past month, starting with Ukraine. Just to review, early this year, the pro-Russian elected president of Ukraine was replaced by a Western allied leader and a U.S.-backed coup. In response, the large ethnic Russian community in eastern Ukraine attempted to secede. With the support of the U.S., the Ukraine central government launched a military offensive against the secessionist cities, which included bombardment of civilian areas. Despite early reverses, the secessionists fought the government to a standstill. Some reports suggest that the improvement in the secessionist fortunes may be due to military assistance from Russia, which regards neighboring Ukraine as vital to its national security. In any event, it was Russian leader Vladimir Putin who recently intervened to help bring about a ceasefire. Marshawn, what is the situation in the Ukraine today, and what's the outlook?
Well, the situation in Ukraine right now is very volatile. I mean, the ceasefire is really only a ceasefire in name at this point. At this stage, the violence is continuing, albeit at not quite the same escalated level it was before, but they're still fighting for control of Donetsk, for the Donetsk airport, and the Ukrainian government is still continuing shelling of the civilian areas. So the outlook, at least at this point, doesn't look very good.
Can you comment on reports that the Ukrainian central government used cluster bombs on Donetsk? And well, what is a cluster bomb?
A cluster bomb, it's basically, it can be dropped from the air or it can be fired from an artillery piece. It is basically a shell or a bomb that contains many, many sub-munitions in it or small bomblets. So when it is dropped, when it is launched, it scatters all these tiny little bombs over a large area. The weapon itself is not technically illegal. However, it is illegal to use in civilian areas because if you are fighting in civilian areas, you want to use what are called point target weapons, meaning weapons that target a specific point. So, for example, if you have a building full of women and children and a building next to it with a sniper in it, you want to hit the building with the sniper. You don't want to hit the one with the women and children. A point weapon hits that specific building, that specific target. However, on the other hand, a cluster bomb is what you would call an area weapon. Any kind of cluster munitions are area weapons, meaning they're designed to hit an area target, a large area. So they don't discern between this building or that building. It just is meant to devastate a large area. And it's illegal to use over civilians for the same reason that the United States condemns Bashar al-Assad's use of barrel bombs in that they don't differentiate between civilian targets or military targets, and that the operator himself or herself cannot differentiate between the two. It's just designed to destroy a large area.
Now, the United States believes that the Russians are actively involved militarily, helping the secessionists. What do you think?
I absolutely believe the Russians are helping the secessionists. I was watching video recently that was leaked out of the Ukraine of Russian tanks being used by the separatists. Now, these were very new T-90 battle tanks, and you can't simply give a T-90 battle tank to a factory worker and tell him, go ahead and drive it, I mean, with much effect. They usually require a significant amount of training because this isn't World War II, where you simply plop a driver in, he turns it on and drives it. These things are very advanced pieces of technology and require knowledge to operate them. So I absolutely believe they're being operated by Russians. Secondly, the use of artillery, which even the former head of NATO, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, he's since retired, showed aerial reconnaissance footage of artillery pieces being driven across the Russian border and engaging in battle. And again, you cannot give any kind of artillery piece, whether it's a small mortar or a 105 artillery piece, you cannot give that to somebody who has no idea what they're doing and expect them to be able to operate it.
Just to recap, the CIA director of the United States visited the capital of Kiev and had his consultations with the head of government there just before this offensive was launched. So presumably it was done with the approval of the United States. Are we providing any equipment or advisors to help the Kiev government bring the secession movement under control?
Well, at this stage, exactly what's being supplied to the Ukrainian government is still up for debate. Originally, it was a big joke because the United States was supplying the Ukrainian government with MREs. But now it's becoming pretty clear that the United States is supplying military advisors, whether in the form of private military contractors or direct military aid. There have been training operations with NATO forces to include U.S. and other NATO members in the west of Ukraine. I've even read reports that a National Guard unit, I believe it's the California National Guard, is looking to deploy to the west of Ukraine sometime next year. So it is very clear that the United States is taking a very active role in the Ukraine. What we're seeing here, for lack of a better term, is a proxy war. And this one's unique, though, in that during the Cold War, from the end of World War II onwards, there was an understanding of spheres of influence. The Russians, the Soviets at the time, had their sphere. That was the Eastern Bloc, because the Russians have a historical paranoia of invasion. They like to either occupy or at least be able to influence the countries that border them. That's why at the end of World War II, to prevent another invasion like the one they experienced with the Germans, they wanted to create a massive buffer zone between them and the rest of the world. But there was the understanding when Stalin met with Truman. When Stalin met with Truman, they built an understanding that the Eastern sphere of influence, the Soviet bloc, is your sphere. We are not going to try to push into your sphere. We're not going to try to invade your sphere. Likewise, Stalin had the understanding with Truman that the Western sphere is your sphere. We are not going to try to push into that. And that's why I've seen several documentaries where they even suggested that the Soviets let communist movements in Western Europe collapse. In Greece and in Italy post-World War II, there were very strong communist movements, and the Soviets let them fall because of that understanding of spheres of influence. In addition, the Americans also allowed several pro-democracy movements in places such as Czechoslovakia collapse.
The Prague Spring of 1968.
Exactly. Yes. There was that tacit understanding that the United States and NATO were not going to enter Czechoslovakia to aid in the Prague Spring. We gave the Soviets a lot of grief about it, but there was never any plan for NATO forces to enter Czechoslovakia to support the Czech pro-democracy movement. So this created a balance in the world. While both the Soviets and the Americans had plans for war with each other, neither side really wanted a all-out war, because the Russians had what they want, which was a buffer zone. We had what we wanted, which was to hem in the Soviet Union. And yeah, we fought each other via proxy in places like Angola, Rhodesia, South Africa, Vietnam, Afghanistan. At no point a time when one was going to send an army into the other's country. And again, it's the same reason Cuba is another example too. But it's also the same reason why the Soviets let Karim Abdul-Qasim in Iraq fall. Karim Abdul-Qasim was pro-communist. He was pro-Soviet. He brought in Soviet bloc military advisors. But when the Ba'athists revolted, there was no question that the Soviet Union was not going to invade Iraq. And now, on the other hand, when we look at the present day, there is clearly no longer that respect for spheres of influence. The NATO pushing into Ukraine is a sort of way of telling the Russians, you will not have a buffer zone. We will not respect your sphere of influence. And therefore, it gives the Russians no reason to respect ours.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. My name is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm your host. I'm here with Gus Canavero, our producer. Joining us also is Marshawn McDermott Rowe, the In Context Military Affairs commentator.
You know, March, when you mentioned the that was it the Prague Spring, is that what you called it?
Yes.
The Americans didn't get involved there, and you said that they used it as a PR campaign to attack the Russians that way. You know, the way I kind of see that, in that time period, the Americans wanted as much catastrophe on the borders of the communist influence as possible so that people were miserable and they would grow to hate the Russians and eventually come over to our side once the communists fell. And that is what happened. And the United States took advantage of, via NATO, that lingering anger toward the communist collapse and the system that they left behind. Once that vacuum of power occurred and NATO rolled in and as a domino effect toward the Russian border, took advantage of situation after situation, bringing them all under the umbrella of NATO and installing missile bases in return, you end up now with a literal half circle
around Russia. Know, as the former Warsaw Pact nations, this was the alliance put together by the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe. Mm. After that collapse, the United States immediately started to rope these countries into NATO.
And yesterday I saw a clip on RT where one of their reporters was asking one of the NATO commanders, is it Russian aggression toward NATO or is it just NATO encirclement of Russia? Because you can see that they've gone all the way up to the Ukraine border. And the commander was saying that they're not going to put a base in Ukraine. And he's saying, well, you may as well. I mean, you're all the way up to the border and you're bickering over Russia's influence in the Ukraine. However, you have a base in every other country around it. Is it NATO's advance upon Russia or is it the Russian aggression toward NATO? And the NATO commander responded, well, NATO is not aggressing toward Russia. And the reporter said, but it's gotten a lot closer. And he said, yes, NATO has expanded. So they want to make sure that they maintain the argument within very specifically focus group tried phrases. So they're going to say NATO has expanded, but they're never going to say it's advanced or it's aggressing or none of these other words because they're just not acceptable to the public.
And from the Russian point of view, how do they regard the Ukraine in terms of their own national security?
Well, just the same as Russia regarded Serbia in 1914. Like I said, Russia likes to have buffer zones because if there's anything that Russian history has taught them, and let's not forget, Russia became first the Kingdom of the Rus in the 12th century. So they're a much older society than we are. They have a very, very long memory. So when we look at this, this is much more than simply Russian imperialism or Russia trying to rebuild the Soviet Union. For them, it's about security because they remember collective memory. They remember when the Austro-Hungarians moved in on their border. They remember when Napoleon marched on Moscow. They remember when the Mongols swept in. They realized without a buffer zone, they are vulnerable to invasion, and they've been invaded. And certainly there are plenty of Russians who, in living memory, remember the German invasion and the German devastation. It is approximately 20 million, and I'd like our listeners to try to grasp that concept for a second. 20 million Russians. Now, many of those were killed due to Stalin's bungles. I mean, Stalin was a military catastrophe, and many of those deaths were completely unnecessary because if Stalin had listen to his generals, such as If he had listened to his generals, such as Zhukov and Chuikov, this would never have happened. You know, you wouldn't have had the level of casualties. But the fact is 20 million Russians did die. So for them, security means much more than thousands of lives or hundreds of thousands of lives. It can mean millions. So that leaves a collective scar, especially when you know your grandparents who had to hide in their cellars and fight the Germans in Stalingrad, you know, when this is in living memory. So that does shape the Russian mindset.
And of course, the Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union for most of the 20th century.
Well, not just that, but the capital of Kiev was the original capital of the Kingdom of the Rus. They were originally called the Kievan Rus. Eastern Ukraine is the traditional heartland of the people of the Rus. And that's why Ukrainian, in many ways, bears such strong resemblances to Russian. I actually was looking through some photographs from the Ukrainian revolution against the pro-Russian government. Somebody had spray-painted on the side of a World War II monument, Slava Ukraini, which means long live the Ukrainian language. But Slava Ukraini would be the same. It's very similar in Russian. It'd be Slava Ukrainsky or, you know, it's Slava means glory. Or long, you know, similar to long live, glory to the Ukrainian language. Slava is a Russian word. So the languages are not all that dissimilar. They're very similar nations, and that's why you see such strong support for Russia.
I might as well say long live pseudo-Russian.
Marchand, another important development affecting U.S.-Russian relationships is the expansion of the so-called missile defense shield. A new missile base is being established in Romania, which will have the Aegis radar and missile interceptor system. That system is now deployed on U.S. ships in the Mediterranean. What is the purpose of those missiles? What do the Russians perceive as the purpose of those missiles?
Well, the purpose of those missiles, they are defensive weapons. It's worth noting they're not offensive, but the Russians view it as a way of hemming them in. In theory, they're designed to stop missiles, and in this case, stop Russian missiles, though we claim in many cases that our missile defense shield is to protect Europe from Iran when they're pointed towards Russia. It's hard for Russia to see it any other way, which means that the U.S. views Russia as a threat. And it's worth noting that the Russian leadership now is the same that existed when President Bush was president. And while President Bush may have been making mistakes, one of the things that's worth noting is that during his presidency, relations with the Russians were never warmer, because just as we had allowed the Prague Spring to collapse, while Bush was president, there was the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, where pro-Western, pro-democracy voters turned out and they voted for the pro-Western candidate. And then the pro-Western candidate was poisoned, we believe, by the Russians. And wouldn't you know it, he suddenly becomes pro-Russian. But there was that tacit understanding that this is your sphere. We're not going to, you know, you leave Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, Poland, and Eastern Europe alone. Those are ours. They're NATO. But non-NATO countries, that's your sphere. You do what you want. And that's why at that time you saw not only warm Russian relations with the U.S., but you saw Russia backing off from confrontation with the U.S., because at the end of the day, Russia is still a Western country. It is still a multi-religious, multi-culture country, much as the U.S. is. We are not inherent adversaries. It's not like the U.S. and China, where China has a completely different value system. They are an atheistic communist state that seeks to expand global Maoism. Russia's not that way. This isn't the Soviet Union anymore. They are a more traditional Russian society. And that's why you saw such close relations with the U.S. And that's also when you saw sort of the toning down of U.S. posture towards Russia. When Obama became president, there was this overt expansion of NATO. There was also this overt expansion of the missile defense shield in recent years as the U.S. started to push Russia more. And again, before, under the Bush administration, we would have let Ukraine stay in the Russian sphere. With Victoria Nuland, President Obama, Joe Biden, John Kerry, they decided it was time for us to push the Russian sphere, decide we must hem in Russia. Again, it was also the same reason why Bush didn't invade Syria or Iran, because both Syria and Iran are in the Russian sphere. Now we're pushing on Syria, we're pushing on Iran. It is clear on every front that we're trying to hem the Russians in on their borders.
Now,
this is a very overt fear of the Russians.
Marchand, the NATO adopted a new treaty provision which allows members of NATO to opt out of missions. What is the significance of that?
Well, the significance of that is huge, because when the United States said, we're going to go into Syria, we're going to topple Bashar al-Assad, he's a war criminal. And Bashar al-Assad's not a nice guy. I'm not defending him by any stretch of the imagination. He is as much a dictator as any dictator in history. But the fact is that when the U.S. said, okay, we're going to bomb Syria, all of these NATO countries said, well, that's it. You can go ahead. We're not going to do it. Britain actually, the parliament voted, in spite of the fact that the prime minister wanted to take part, Britain voted not to get involved in Syria when the U.S. goal was to topple Assad. They remember being dragged into Iraq and Afghanistan, and they saw that those turned into abject failures, and that before the mission was complete, President Obama walked away. So they spent their blood and their money fighting these wars alongside the U.S., only to be left really in the dust. And so these European countries, their mentality was, no, we're not going to get involved. So for the first time, NATO said, we are not going to participate. You want to do it, go nuts, but we're not going to participate. And that was a major setback and the main reason why the United States didn't get involved, in addition to the fact that, according to numerous sources, stretching from Debka File, which is an Israeli intelligence newsletter, to Haaretz, Russia Today, Al Arabiya, and various other news agencies, that there are Russian troops on the ground, SOBR counterterrorism units, Russian ships in the port of Tartus, and even the deployment of Russian Iskander ballistic missiles, which was reported in ABC News and on Fox. So it's no secret the Russians have troops there. They also deployed surface-to-air missile systems. So there was also the risk that if we bombed Syria without the help of NATO, we would potentially find ourselves in a direct confrontation with the Russian bear. without the support of NATO. So, and that was another reason why the NATO countries didn't want to get involved.
The name of the show is The In Context War Report. If you just tuned in, we're broadcasting the fourth Monday of the month from noon to 1 p.m. on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm here with the producer, Gus Canavero, and our military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott Rowe. Marchand, didn't all this new mentality really start as soon as the Cold War ended, when Gorbachev started to reach an understanding with Reagan? Soon after Reagan left office, 89-90, Gorbachev unilaterally ended the Cold War by renouncing the Brezhnev Doctrine, letting go of Eastern Europe, democratizing the Soviet Union, making it a voluntary association, legitimizing non-communist parties. He really paved the way for, I think, a new, more peaceful world in the wake of the end of the Cold War. And the first thing the United States did under Reagan's successor, George Bush the Elder, was to invade the Persian Gulf. You know, we are now in a drive for as the world hegemon, and there's nobody in our way. It seems to me from that point on, 24 years ago, we really decided that we wanted to assert
supremacy. At the drop or the increase in corruption and the drop of morals that has taken place in the United States here at home as a result of this warmongering mentality. You know, you have no-knock SWAT team raids, and you have the war on drugs exploding to a stupid level where they just arrest anybody for anything, and you have asset forfeiture seizure where you have cops running around just like taking whatever they want from people and you can't even get it back. Where does it end?
There have always been empires, and there is necessarily a need for empires often because it keeps a balance. But there has to be that understanding of spheres of influence. Yeah, we'll poke each other through proxy, but fundamentally, we have a tacit understanding. This is your area. This is our area. And it keeps the world in balance. The problem is when one nation sees the opportunity to become the world's sole hegemon, and we see that with the outbreak of World War I, we see that in World War II, we see that with the Seven Years' War, we see that with the Napoleonic Wars. The Napoleonic Wars were the prime example. Napoleon and the French felt that it was their chance to become the one true hegemon. That is when you start to have these problems. And I think after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was that sense amongst leaders in the United States of, well, now is our chance to be the only superpower, because our one rival, Russia's gone, China is fundamentally backwards, you know, Deng Xiaoping had just taken power, and China was fundamentally still in living in the 50s, or even, you know, pre-1950s, technologically speaking. So we really were the world's unchallenged superpower, and it was kind of our opportunity to take that. Well, the problem is that we're no longer the world's unchallenged superpower. Now we have to return to that Reagan doctrine of spheres of influence, that Truman doctrine of spheres of influence, which says that this area is yours, this area is ours. Well, yeah, we'll poke and prod at each other. We don't like each other, but we have to reach an understanding. And the problem is we don't have that anymore. Just as Austro-Hungary wanted to push into the Russian sphere of influence, just as Napoleon wanted to push into the British sphere of influence, we're seeing the exact same thing going on today. That is what ultimately leads to major world conflict.
Well, Marchand, we talked about how there were spheres of influence during the Cold War, and our theme today is proxy warfare. Could we talk about some of the wars that occurred during the Cold War? For example, Vietnam in the 1960s and the early 70s. The major powers were also involved. The United States had 500,000 troops there at one point. Well, the Russians were involved as well, right?
Yes, they had lots of military advisors. I mean, it's hard to pick a number on how many military advisors they had. They had a lot of military advisors. There are accounts of U.S. forces at times engaging what they believed were Russian troops. It was definitely a proxy war at its finest. What made Vietnam the quintessential proxy war was the fact that the Soviets saw it as a chance to drain us, weaken us, expand their sphere of influence a little bit. But at the end of the day, there was no idea, there was no thought in the Kremlin that we are going to send 500,000 Russians to go duke it out with the Americans. And similarly, in Afghanistan, we sent guns and advisors to the Mujahideen, but there was no idea that we were, going to send 500,000 Americans to go fight the million Russians.
Could you talk a little about how that came about? This would be starting, I think, under Carter, or definitely under Reagan in the 1980s, the United States took up the cause of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. What was the connection between Russia and the Afghan government?
The Afghans had had a communist revolution back in the 70s, and the government, it was an authoritarian government, to say the least, but it had strongly alienated the local Afghan population. It was led by Afghan intellectuals, urbanized Afghans from places like Kabul, Herat. This ultimately alienated the rural Afghans and make up the majority of the population. So the government was in a precarious position, and the Soviets decided, listen, we have to do away with this current Afghan communist leader. We have to reestablish communist rule. And they invaded Afghanistan. And this would be in 1979 was when they invaded Afghanistan. Very quickly, they began encountering resistance. Now, that was ostensibly the reason for the Soviet invasion. The real reason was that they were afraid, due to traditional Russian paranoia and bad intelligence, that the U.S. were going to sponsor movements against the teetering Soviet regime, particularly because Pakistan was pro-American. And again, at the time, Afghanistan was on Russia's doorstep.
And yes, so and Russia and Great Britain had fought three wars, essentially, over Afghanistan.
Exactly. But the Russian fear at the time was that the U.S. was going to push into Afghanistan. They had bad intelligence telling them that we were ready to push in Afghanistan. So their fear was that if the Soviet government or communist government there fell, they would lose Afghanistan and now again have an enemy right on their doorstep. So they invaded Afghanistan in 79. Very rapidly, a Mujahideen, for lack of a better term, soldiers of the faith, began rising up to fight against the Soviets. Well, they were poorly armed. They had no training. And the Soviets were really wiping the floor with them. But they were one thing. It was a bleeding ulcer for Russia. And Reagan and his administration decided, hey, you know, the Russians are having their own Vietnam. Why don't we kind of egg this on? Why don't we get our own back? And it was illogical. It was a very logical response considering the environment of the Cold War and fighting each other through proxy.
And after our experience in Vietnam, where we've been defeated partly through the Russian support for North Vietnam.
Exactly. In great part. To the Russian support, because the North Vietnamese would never have held it together if it weren't for Russian support. And it was one of those things that really did bring the Russians to the negotiating table, because they had been bled by the Brezhnev doctrine of aggressive Soviet expansion and aggressive Soviet involvement, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we began supplying the Mujahideen with arms. We were training them with our advisors in Pakistan. And it gradually drained the Soviets to the point that they were forced to withdraw. And again, it was a very logical reaction to the proxy wars that were going on at the time.
Ironically, Marchand, perhaps the nuclear weapon issue was one of the reasons why neither Vietnam nor Afghanistan turned into other than a proxy warfare. They didn't turn into a major power confrontation because of mutually assured destruction. That is, if we launch, if we escalate to a major war between Russia and the United States, it's going to quickly turn nuclear and we'll destroy each other. And that's not an option. And that doesn't seem to be a factor anymore. It seems like nobody's going to use nuclear bombs, so that's just not going to happen. So we don't seem to have that anymore.
I equate nuclear weapons to chemical weapons, because chemical weapons were originally used during World War I. That was the first. I mean, there were other attempts at chemical weapons. We go back to the Middle Ages, throwing rotting corpses and animals over the walls of castle. But really, the modern chemical weapons, mustard gas, chlorine, all those were used during the First World War. During World War II, both sides had very large stockpiles of chemical weapons. And several of Hitler's generals had approached him and said, listen, you know, the war is not quite going our way. What if we drop a huge amount of mustard, sarin, any other chemical weapons they had on London? And Hitler was outraged and said, no, we can't do that. Because if we drop chemical weapons on London, the Allies will saturate us with chemical weapons. And this is still when Germany was in a relatively strong position. This wasn't 1945. This would have been sometime in 44 when it still seemed possible for Germany to at least reach a stalemate with the Allies. Even then, they did not, and no matter how bad things got, and this is something worth noting, 44 into 45, when things got really bad, when Allied troops were getting ready to cross the Rhine, when the Soviets were on the Oder in northern Germany, the Germans still did not use chemical weapons against the Soviets or the Americans or the British or the French, because there was the fear that it would be used against them. And I view chemical weapons as the same thing. Now, again, during the Cold War, yeah, there was a genuine fear that one side would mutually assure destruction. But as we have learned since the Cold War, no matter how bad things get, no one side is going to use nuclear weapons. I mean, I could guarantee that American troops could be within sight of the spires of the Kremlin, or Russian troops could be within sight of Chicago, and neither side would still use nuclear weapons because of the retaliatory response of the other. So one thing the mutually assured destruction theory taught us was that no side at the end of the day has the chutzpah to actually use nuclear weapons, because you'll be obliterated by the other side. So that's why I view the nuclear deterrent nowadays as being the same as the chemical weapons deterrent during World War II.
Excuse me, Marshawn, if listeners just tuned in, you are listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org around the fourth Monday of the month from noon to 1 p.m. And in our show, we attempt to explain to you not only the latest developments in the global wars, but also the historical context for these developments, so you can understand what they really mean and you can understand their impact on the United States national security. I'm your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe. I'm here with our producer, Gus Canifaro. And joining us is our military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott-Rowe. Our theme for our show is really proxy warfare as it relates to the current conflict, for example, in Ukraine, between the United States and Russia. And we've talked about past proxy wars in Vietnam and in Afghanistan, which did not go beyond being proxy wars. They did not result in a major war between the United States and Russia. But I'd like to talk for a few minutes about a very important proxy war that eventually did lead to a great war, and that's the Spanish Civil War, which took place between 1936 and 1939, which turned out to be a dress rehearsal for World War II. Marshawn, could you talk about what the causes of the Spanish Civil War were, and who were the major players?
The causes of the Spanish Civil War were left-wing revolution that was really in the time of the late 20s and into the 30s was sweeping across Europe. It was what led ultimately to the rise of Benito Mussolini and the fascists in places like Italy and the Nazis in Germany, was fear of the Red Revolution, because the Russians had been sort of, you know, not necessarily directly aiding these revolutions, because Stalin had the idea of socialism in one country, which for lack of a better term meant he, once again, as I mentioned, spheres of influence, he wasn't about to send the Red Army to support a communist revolution in Hungary. But that having been said, it was a trend that was beginning to sweep the Western world. And it is worth noting that at the time, the crimes of Joseph Stalin were unknown to the rest of the world. So it was the ideology of sort of the landless peasant, the factory worker who didn't own anything. It was very idealistic, and it led to a lot of violent revolution across Europe. But Spain was where it broke out in its most intense, because Spain was, unlike Italy or Germany or Hungary even, was a very agrarian country, really stuck in the 19th century. And so we begin to see this sort of left-wing coalition erupting onto the scene. And that was when, on the other hand, you see Francisco Franco and the fascists rise as the representatives of the urban intellectual, the representatives of the middle class, who then enter to fight against the communists.
Now, the left-wingers were actually the government of Spain, right? It was a republic.
Exactly. They were known as the Republicans because they represented the government of Spain. And they represented what they said was the Republic. But it really was a left-wing coalition, because it consisted not only of communists, but also socialists, Trotskyites, Stalinists. It consisted of anarchists. Pretty much everybody on the left joined with the government of the Republic. Franco represented the army, but he also represented the intellectual, the middle class, and the church, because one of the first signs of this new left-wing revolution was the murder of nuns, priests. It was the burning of churches, mosques. I mean, it was the destruction of everything traditional Spain had created over the last hundreds, if not thousand years of Spanish existence.
So how did the war progress? How did the Civil War progress? And what did the major powers do about it?
Well, as there was a back and forth between the left-wing coalition, and indeed there was a right-wing coalition, because as I mentioned, the middle class, the church, the monarchists and whatnot, it became a very internationalized conflict, as we can also see in the Ukraine too, with all these foreign volunteers arriving from all over the world to fight for the right-wingers in the pro-Western government and the left-wingers in the pro-Russian separatists. In Spain, we saw something very similar. Volunteers from all over the world flocked to Spain to fight for both sides. In the case of the socialists, we see the Connolly Battalion, all Irish left-wing volunteers, the Lincoln Brigade, which was all American left-wing volunteers. And then on the fascist side, we see a little-known group called the Green Shirts, Ian O'Duffy's fascists from Ireland, who went and fought on the side of Franco. And so it became a very internationalized conflict. But the other thing worth mentioning is that in this internationalized conflict, we also saw the Soviets aiding the communists. And in addition to that, we saw the Nazis and the Italian fascists supporting Franco and his fascists. So this was a bit of departure from the Stalinist doctrine of socialism in one country, because he saw a chance to hem in the fascist powers, but also to hem in the Western powers.
So really, if Franco could overthrow the legitimate elected left-wing government of Spain, then all bets were off as far as fascists expanding. Of course, the German government and the Italian government were fascists. And just to give some statistics on their support, Italy, I think, was the most involved. They sent 50,000 troops to fight for the Franco's right-wing group. The Italian Navy actually broke the Republican blockade of the rebels' ports in Morocco. Italy contributed 660 planes, 150 tanks, 800 artillery pieces, as well as a number of machine guns and rifles. And Germany, while they didn't send as many troops, they did send quite a few planes, which were very important because they were far superior to the planes supplied to the Republic by the Soviet Union. So they were in there big time. And it's very interesting that the United States, although there were many intellectuals in the United States that sympathized with the Republic, and many volunteers went over to fight in Spain for the Republic, and groups called, like the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, the United States government did not officially support the Republican government of Spain. Either did the British government. Was that a mistake on their part? Do you think that they should have confronted the fascists in Spain? Would that perhaps have precluded World War II?
I don't think it would have precluded World War II, because it's worth mentioning that while Franco was a fascist, he was not a Nazi. You know, I had an old friend of mine who once said that all Nazis were fascists, but not all fascists were Nazis. Fascism, in a sense, is an ideology of nationalism. And Franco had no desire to get involved in World War II. So I don't think either way it would have resulted in preventing World War II. It probably would have resulted in more communist expansion post-World War II. One of the reasons why the United States didn't get involved and Britain didn't get involved in Spain was because it was sort of a love-hate relationship. The United States didn't necessarily feel comfortable with the fascists, but it felt even more uncomfortable with the communists, because at the time there were very large left-wing movements in both Britain and America. And indeed, had there been a successful communist revolt in Spain, which would have made Spain red, that would have egged on the communists in America and the communists in Britain and throughout the rest of Europe. Indeed, World War II might have actually seen us fighting on the side of Italy and Germany, just as we allied ourselves with a genocidal tyrant like Stalin, we might have allied ourselves with Hitler to fight the Red Tide.
No, the United States was chummy with Hitler all the way up until the point where they started to fight.
It's a case of realpolitik, you know. Sometimes you have to sacrifice your ideals because you see a greater threat. And certainly, I think in that case, we would have seen a much larger red tide spread across Europe.
Why do you think World War II
would have been different, not necessarily prevented?
Why do you think that the confrontation between the fascists and the communists did not remain at the proxy war stage? Why did it advance to a major power conflict?
A lot of that stemmed from the fact that it eliminated that concept of spheres of influence. It was the precursor to a major war because it was a departure from the traditional idea of spheres of influence. It gave the Germans a sense and the Italians a sense and even the Soviets a sense, because let's not forget, in 1939, when Germany invaded Western Poland, Russia, as part of the secret protocol with the pact with which they signed with Germany, they themselves were expanding. What this demonstrated was that departure from spheres of influence, and that's ultimately why it led to World War II, because countries now felt it's our time in the sun. America is absent. Britain is weak. France is weak. So ergo, now's our chance to expand. And that's really what led to World War II. And it's also worth noting that the conflict in Spain was incredibly intense, because for the rest of the world, what they saw in the Republican government in Spain, legitimate though it was, they were butchers. They went and they burned churches. They murdered priests. They murdered nuns. They raped and pillaged anything that didn't agree with them or conform to their idea of communism or left-wing socialism. So that's also another reason why Franco ultimately won, was because he had, when you look at Franco's army, you see a tremendous coalition. You know, he had large numbers of North Africans who fought in the Spanish army, Muslim Moors from North Africa, because they too were afraid of the Red Tide, because the Red Tide represented the destruction of religion, the destruction of the family, the destruction of the middle class. And they, and the Republicans acted upon that. So that also added to the tension of the time, was that for the Europeans, particularly for Germany and Italy also, it represented that communism and that the Soviet Union was no longer just going to be a nation that stood by on the doorstep. If somebody did not take the place of Great Britain, the Soviet Union may very well sweep across Europe. And in Russia's similar fear, since it was clear that the balance had been broken, Russia's fear now was that fascism would sweep Europe and that they would be bunched into a corner. And Britain, meanwhile, those sitting on the sidelines, also felt that fear of the expanding Red Tide and the expanding fascist tide. It was very clear at the time that expansion was on everybody's mind, and that if nothing was done to confront this expansionism, one person was going to be on top, and it wasn't going to be who the other side wanted it to be, if that makes any sense. So that's what ultimately led this to breaking out into a wider war in 1939.
It seemed like there were two trends going on that led up to World War II. One, of course, was the ideological conflict between the fascists and the communists, between democracies and autocratic governments. But it was also the unresolved question as to whether the German Empire would be allowed to challenge the British Empire. That was really the cause for World War I, although the United States became involved in order to help save the British Empire. Again, the two wars were really one war with an intermission. And the Germans were insisting on...
Not much of one, though. There's still wars going on.
Right. But it really, from 1918, World War I ends. And then when Germany moves into the Rhineland in 1936, I'd say that was really the beginning of World War II. Mm. The Germans were insisting they had their right to place in the sun. And the British were saying, no, we're not going to tolerate the rise of the German Empire. I wonder, do you see some kind of rough analogy between the United States' role in its military expansion since the end of the Cold War and perhaps, say, France under Napoleon expanding to dominate all of Europe, or Germany in the 1930s moving ahead, or perhaps the British Empire earlier expanding, almost unstoppable, controlling a very large part of the globe? Is this our turn to go for that? You know, the big prize of world domination? Is that what we're seeing played out?
I think I would compare our state now much more to that of Austro-Hungary in 1914 or Britain in 1936, 1939, that time period. Russia is in the position that Napoleon was in, or the position that Germany was in, because after the Battle of Valmy, when France realized it could beat Britain, they realized, and the other European powers, they realized that, well, hey, maybe it's our chance to be in the sun. And
this is right at the end of the French Revolution, and all the countries around France that resented the revolution were trying to close in and put an end to it, right?
Exactly. And these were the traditionally ruling empires of Europe. And so when they were defeated, France kind of felt on a high that, well, now we can expand. And especially after the shame of their defeats before the revolution under Louis XVI and Louis XV, this really gave them a sense that, you know, now's our time to get our own back. And that's why Russia today is really in the position that Germany was in post-Treaty of Versailles. The Russians were shamed by the collapse of the Soviet Union. They were hemmed in by the U.S. The U.S. said, okay, well, now it's our chance to, you know, assert our place in the sun, just as Britain did at the end of World War I, really assert, you know, we're in charge, basically. Russians, just like Germans, but Russians especially, don't like being pushed into a corner. Russia right now is in that stage that Germany was in the 1936. It's not necessarily that the Russians feel they need Lebensgrund, living space, for their surplus population, but rather they seek to reassert themselves as a superpower and reassert their security and national dignity, just as Germany did in 1936, wanting to reassert that it was a world power. And Britain, the United States, and France were very frightened of that. Germany was on an imperial march. They did believe that they needed living space. Whereas on the other hand, the Russians don't believe they need living space, but they believe they need buffer space. Russia, after its defeat in the Cold War, after its shame in the Cold War, is on the expansion mode to reassert itself as a world power. The United States, meanwhile, is still trying to assert we are still a world power. We're still the ones in charge, just as Britain attempted to do in the 30s, just as France attempted to do in the 30s. They try to still assert that we are, hey, Germany, step back. We're still the ones in charge here.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host. I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator, Gus Cantavero, our producer. And we've been talking about proxy wars with reference to the current global wars, particularly in the Ukraine. We're also talking about past proxy wars, such as the Spanish Civil War, to assess their relevance to this current situation, to assess whether the current proxy wars might develop into a major conflict between the United States and Russia, and perhaps even between the United States and China. We should, I think, at least briefly mention what's going on in China with respect to oil, with respect to the United States possibly confronting China. That was really largely what our intervention in 3 years ago in Libya, when we overthrew the government of Gaddafi and brought about his assassination, was really to check China's oil operations in Libya. Libya is one of the biggest oil producers in Africa. They had thousands of workers there who were forced out after we overthrew the Gaddafi government. Right now, there are a great many Chinese oil companies working their way through Africa. And very recently, there's a very important paper published by the Strategic Studies Institute of the U.S. Army War College entitled Africa's Booming Oil and Natural Gas Exploration, the National Security Implications for the United States in China. It's a brilliant article by a man named David E. Brown. If you just put David Brown into Google with Africa oil, it should pop up. In this lengthy and detailed paper, it's well over 100 pages, he notes that 51 of the 54 countries in Africa now have planned or ongoing oil and gas operations. So Africa is the future as far as oil goes. And for China, Africa is going to be very, very important because Africa is going to become a major source of oil and natural gas for China. That's why they were in Libya. And while the United States has been importing African oil, we don't need it as much as China does. It's our involvement there is really to preclude their access to oil. So if we can keep them away, then they become less formidable as adversaries. I think this may relate to the fact that President Obama plans to send up to 4,000 U.S. troops to West Africa, supposedly to combat the Ebola epidemic. I understand they're not going to be equipped with hazmat suits, so I really wonder if possibly this is a pretext for increasing what is already a very extensive military involvement in Africa. We now have, according to the Washington Post, U.S. troops in at least 14 African countries. And of course, in 2007, Bush the Younger established the U.S. Africa Command. So we are very involved in
AFRICOM.
AFRICOM. We are over there conducting annual training exercises. It's codenamed Operation Flintlock. We've been doing that for about 9 years now. We're involved with U.S. drone strikes in Somalia. Mm-hmm. We have proxy fighters in Somalia and in Mali. We have our Green Berets equipping and training elite so-called counterterrorism units in Libya, Niger, Mauritania, and Mali. So we're all over Africa right now.
Yeah.
Marshawn, do you think that perhaps this new mission to West Africa in connection with Ebola may be just a way of escalating our military involvement to check China?
Oh, it's entirely possible. I mean, the Ebola crisis is definitely being exploited, whether it's media sensationalism or the administration trying to push ISIS and Russia off the news headlines because those have both been total failures on the part of the administration, or whether it's an excuse to expand U.S. influence in Africa.
Bingo.
It's hard to say. The U.S. has definitely been expanding its influence into Africa tremendously. And a lot of that is done to check the power of China. We would be naive to think that our foreign policy has really changed that much since the Cold War. We are afraid, just as we were of the Russians getting a hold of South Africa, we're just as afraid of the Chinese getting a hold of the oil-rich countries of Africa, because if they do, it does make China more formidable. What holds China back militarily is the fact that it doesn't have its own supply of oil. And that's one of the reasons why we've also been trying to check Chinese expansionism in the Pacific into these oil-rich areas like the Senkaku Islands south of Japan, which the Chinese recently seized, several of them, and their expansion just off the coast of Vietnam to build oil rigs.
Yes, there's another place of and in his paper, David Brown says that China, feeling pushed by the United States, will accelerate the adoption of a two-ocean military strategy that includes an enduring presence in the Indian Ocean as well as the Pacific Ocean.
China really is at a point in its history where it hasn't been for a very long time. China saw itself as the central kingdom, as the island, if you will, of civilization, all other men barbarians. And in fact, before the Opium Wars, when British diplomats arrived in Peking, the Chinese referred to them as the barbarians. They viewed the West with contempt. And then the Opium Wars and the following Boxer Rebellion and the dividing up of China amongst the powers taught China that the outside world is not backwards, but dangerous. And so for the first time really in Chinese history, and it's 3,000 years of history, excluding the Mongol invasion, China really finds itself in a position where it's either be divided up by the West or take over the West. If we want to look at the real threats to Western civilization, we have to look at ISIS and China, because China is in an expansionist point in its history. The only thing holding it back is its lack of oil. And certainly that's a main reason why they're provoking their neighbors to get a hold of the oil resources.
Marshawn, unfortunately, we're coming near the end of the show, but this last point you've mentioned points to a very significant policy question. Do you think that we should realign ourselves then away from this confrontation with Russia towards an alliance with Russia and perhaps Iran with the view towards countering the growing power of China?
Absolutely. I absolutely think that, look, realpolitik is what it is. You have to say, you know what? Yeah, we don't like the fact that it is an authoritarian, undemocratically elected government in Ukraine. We don't like the fact that the Russians want to push their influence in their own sphere. Fine. But the fact is that we can do business with the Russians. They are Westerners. Though they're Eastern Europeans, they're still Europeans. They still adhere to the same Western values. And not to say non-European countries don't. The South Koreans are non-Europeans, but they're a Western country. So when I say European, when I say Western, I don't mean in a racial or in a geographical sense, but I mean it in a cultural sense. They're countries that are multi-religious, multicultural. But when you look at a country like China, it is really a version of ISIS on steroids. It is an authoritarian nation which seeks to exterminate everything that does not adhere to its ideal. And we see that with the absolute genocide committed against the Tibetans and the ethnic Uyghurs and all the ethnic minorities in China. China is a country that we shouldn't be doing business with. China is a country we should be really buffering ourselves against.
Yeah.
We can do business with the Russians. The Russians are our natural allies. They are a multi-ethnic, multicultural melting pot, same as we are. Their natural adversary should be the Chinese. Even during the Cold War, they were at odds with the Chinese. But now instead, we are pushing the Chinese and the Russians closer together. Because if we brought the Russians into our sphere through economic cooperation, through an understanding of spheres of influence, and an understanding that China and ISIS and such organizations are the real threat, as Russia too sees ISIS as a threat, we could really hem in the power of China and then at the same time create with the Chinese an understanding that, look, you have your area, it's your region of Asia, but you push into our area, you'll find yourself fighting the world. And in that sense, we could keep a global balance.
Marshawn,
the problem is if we push Russia into China's sphere, we now create a power block which could potentially really hurt us.
Marshawn, thank you very much for your insights. That's the end of our show, this edition of the In Context War Report. The In Context War Report is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., and is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. This program will be archived at WPKN.org, at RadioForAll.org, and on our show's website, incontextreport.com. And you can sign up for podcasts of the series via iTunes and Radio for All. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. On behalf of In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe, producer Gus Canifaro, this is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
See ya.
See ya.